just so people know that we are beginning to video stream these talks, and even those which weren't actually video streamed live. My president told me a couple of weeks ago that, you know, we think maybe about 300 people, we never really count people here, listen to these talks live, but about 17,000 listen to it on the internet. It's a huge number, 17,000, in places as far away as Iceland. So to the group in Iceland, good evening to you all. But this evening's talk is going to be on the Buddhist attitude towards sensuality. Now, we live in a sensual world, and sometimes some religions, they have a very eccentric response to the sensuality which is around them. And we see that with people, you know, enforcing their women folk to wear burqas, or even, say, in the Amish community, asking people to wear loose-fitting, unsensual clothes. And you look at the monks and nuns in front of you, and this is, you know, our idea of a burqa, or is it? What is it? And what is, like, the Buddhist attitude towards sensuality in this world? Certainly that's an important question, because some of ideas about the problems of sensuality and the joys of sensuality have a huge impact on the way that they live their lives and the way they act upon other people. So this is why I wanted to talk about this in Buddhism. And certainly you see from all the people here that we don't sort of ask people to come and wear a non-sensual clothes. Sometimes there are some of you here who think, oh, you know, we have some very young monks here, we don't want to lose those monks. And it has happened in the past, there may be a skimpily clad, a young girl comes in and they're ushered outside. And please don't do that, simply because that's going to offend somebody, and you should have more confidence in your monks. And you wouldn't do that if there was a hunky man came in here when Sister Ajahn Wayama was giving a talk. So the point is here, you see in Buddhism we don't have anything like veils. And there's a good reason for this. Certainly that sensuality is there, and sensuality can cause problems in the world. You know, we do have problems with paedophiles. We do have people with problems with sexual predators. We do have problems with even rapists. We do have problems with other addictions, not just sexual addictions, such as overeating, or people who are addicted to pornography, or people who eat too much or gamble too much. There are many addictions in this world which are concerning sensuality. So, you know, there is a problem there. But sometimes there is a problem if we try and suppress it just too vigorously, because that impinges upon our freedoms and our wishes to enjoy the world in which we are born into. And so, what is the Buddhist attitude towards these problems, so that we can live and enjoy our life, but at the same time try and avoid as best as we can some of the extremes of sensuality? And I think just the way I've defined this talk tonight, I think you've already got the clue that the Buddha was always talking about a middle way, not to go to extremes. And it's the extreme parts of this which have caused the problem. But with sensuality, we can actually understand, just when we watch our mind especially, that it's not so much sort of what's out there, but the way we respond to what's out there, which is the biggest problem in life. And one of the key stories which I grew up with was coming from my own teacher, Ajahn Chah, who, being a monk, obviously you have a different value system when it comes to sensuality. You know, monks and nuns are celibate. And to live a celibate life, you know, in the world, obviously the monks and the nuns cannot really escape from the sensual objects out there, whether it's food or whether it's sex or whether it's movies or whatever. So actually, how do you deal with this? And one of Ajahn Chah's stories was that when he was a young, lusty novice, you know, 18, 19 years of old age, with all the hormones running through him. He wanted to become a monk, but obviously he saw young Thai girls and he would have lust towards them. And so for 3 months, during our period of like what we call rains retreat, the time when, you know, I don't come here, Sister Wayama doesn't come here. Now, those of you who've been coming here for a long time know for 3 months we always go back into our monasteries. He was staying in a town monastery, so for 3 months he decided he would not look at any girl at all. He'd keep his eyes down and not even look at anybody, thinking that that type of restraint would overcome his lust. And so for 3 months he refused to even look at a girl. And he said what happened. For those 3 months he was fine, but after his resolution was completed, the first girl he looked at, he went crazy with lust. And this is one of the problems, that just not looking, not facing up to the problem, is actually not overcoming it. It actually makes it much worse. And that's why that asking people to cover up, also so the monks, so the nuns don't see anybody, or you to cover up, it doesn't really help the situation, because as soon as, you know, the covers are taken off, people actually go crazy. It's actually almost just suppressing something. Now, if you suppress it and don't understand it, usually that there's a bigger explosion later on. The simile which I've often given, if anyone here is meditating, you feel like coughing, please cough straight away. Because if you don't cough straight away and you suppress it, when you do cough, it's like a volcano going up off, and you just disturb everybody. And sometimes that type of suppression is typical of just some of the ways which we deal with the problems in our world. And so that we live in such a world, we have to, instead of trying to cover up the triggers with burkas or with veils or with people dressing up in sort of loose-fitting clothing and not accentuating, you know, your bodies and not wearing scents and makeup and goodness knows what else, that won't solve the problem. Now, the problem has to be solved actually in one's relationship with the sensory world. And that certainly is the Buddhist attitude. It's, and again, not just with sexuality, it's with food. And sometimes people come to our monasteries, both the Gijiganup and to Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, and think, my goodness, look at all the delicious food that you monks eat. We had complaints in the first years when I was a monk, because sometimes we had these Thai ladies married to Australians, and they'd come and bring food to the 2 monks who were there. This was before Sister Wayama came. And sometimes that the Australian men, the husbands, would complain. They say, my wife never cooks anything like that for me. This is unfair. And the Thai wife said, well, you should become a monk, then I'll cook for you. And we got the most delicious food. And so sometimes people would complain to the monks, you're supposed to be monks. Why are you eating such delicious food? You should just eat ordinary food, just like bread and water. That's probably the best for you. Then we'd respect you even more. But sometimes I tried that my first year as a monk. For a practice, I put all the food together, which was disgusting anyway, and I got the spoon and mixed it all up. And I only ate one meal a day, and so it was a sludge, it was a slop. And if you saw it, you'd actually pour it out straight away. It wasn't even fit for pigs, let alone for monks. But the trouble was, it was an interesting experiment which I did. Every food, doesn't matter what it was, the sweets, everything in one bowl, and stirred it up till it was absolutely consistent. After a while, it actually started to taste nice. It was a weird thing, but the way that sensuality works, now after a while, no matter what it is, you start to like it. You start to become attractive, delicious, and tasty. So what it made very clear to me, it was not the food which was the problem. No matter what food you have there, after a while it becomes delicious and you crave it. It doesn't matter what, sort of as a male monk, what women you see, after a while, even if they're in burkas, after a while the burkas start to appear sort of attractive. Whatever it is, so the attraction is not in the object out there. and you can like anything after a while. So it's quite clear that the reaction to the dangers of sensuality should never be sort of be concerned with the triggers of sensuality. Even in Singapore, they're just going to be opening up a couple of casinos. And obviously that the sensuality, is the sensuality of gambling, the thrill of it, the excitement of it, is also problematical. But we don't solve that problem by banning all the casinos. Because what happens when you ban the casinos, then you have illegal casinos. It's not really the thing outside which is the problem. It's the way we react to them. It's our attitude towards these things. And so I was actually quite glad that I had, you know, because I have a group in Singapore and they showed me some of these documents and they asked me my opinion about those casinos in Singapore. And I told them, and I'm very glad the Singapore government was actually following, well, I didn't really follow the advice, it was really, I understood what they were going to do anyway, was actually not to stop these things, but actually to contain the worst parts of gambling by having legislation in place which can stop the addictive gamblers. And for other people who aren't addictive, actually to show some restraint. And that is actually what's going to be happening in Singapore. So that loan sharks, you know, the money lenders, they can't be in those casinos exploiting people's addictions. Nor if a person is going to that casino too often, their family or even themselves can voluntarily ask for themselves to be banned. If it's going to be causing financial trouble or social trouble, they can be put on the blacklist, and sometimes they volunteer themselves. It's a way of actually dealing with the worst parts of gambling. Because other than that, I remember as a kid that I would sort of have a bet on, in England it was called the Derby or the Grand National, two races, horse races, you would bet on every year. And it was only like, you know, 2 shillings or whatever. It was for fun and you never expected to win anything. If you did, you just shared it with your friends. And that to me never seemed to be like a problem. But of course that sometimes the addictive gambling is the problem. In the same that the sensuality which ordinary human beings have in the world, I'm not talking about monks now, I'm talking about lay communities, you know, having a partner in life, you know, having relationships, having sex, the ordinary type of stuff is usually not problematical except if you get too far and get addicted or get too far under the power of one's sensuality. And this is actually where we have to have ways of not dealing so much with the trigger out there, because you can't really control that trigger out there, but dealing with our attitudes towards these things. And so, as Buddhists, sometimes people think we're so tolerant. You know, you can have like, in Buddhist countries like Thailand, you know, just have lots of prostitutes. You know, have in Singapore like gambling, or have like people wearing skimpy clothes or whatever. And, you know, anything goes sometimes, they said in Buddhism. I think that was Tina Turner when she became a Buddhist. Why did you become a Buddhist? I think she was quoted as saying, because you can do anything you like in Buddhism. That's not quite true. I hope I didn't misquote her, but it's the triggers outside we're not so concerned with. So the Buddhist response is actually to try and work in one's attitude towards these things in life. And in order to work on those attitudes, we have something we call like mindfulness. We're aware of how these things affect us. And we also understand with some wisdom about the dangers in these things. So, you know, like gambling, it can be fun, but there's obviously a danger there. And we use our awareness, our mindfulness, actually to know how far we can go and what the danger is. The same with the relationships and sex, the sensuality of lust. We know what the advantages are, we know what the dangers are of it. And also whatever else, whether it's eating, whether it's watching movies, whether it's watching the internet or whatever, we know the dangers which are there. And this is not stopping the things out there, it's actually stopping the way we relate to them when it gets too far. And obviously, like, you know, sexuality, we know there's dangers there. When we're talking about dangers, There was never ever in Buddhism, it's one of the reasons why I was inspired to be a Buddhist, there was never anything like, you know, evil or sin or, you know, you're a bad boy because, you know, you had sex with a girl or something. That badness and evil, that ultimate, you know, bad thing was never there. Instead, it was always this, it was almost like a precursor of utilitarianism. Because the Buddha would say the basic ethics, and I repeat this many, many times, it's not just anything goes in Buddhism, but is what you are going to do, or say, or even think, is it going to be harmful to others or harmful to yourself? If it is, it's called not bad, not evil, unskillful. It's a great word, unskillful, because it doesn't have any like moral judgments, as if it comes from some absolute, you know, this is bad and this is good. Because if it says this is bad, this is good, and you're told it by someone else, you don't have to think it out for yourself, you believe it. And because of those blind beliefs, we get into terrible troubles in this world. We don't even think it out for ourselves. And so because we believe that blowing ourselves up is going to send us to heaven, we do such stupid things. Or because we believe that, say, sex is bad, we get these puritans. But what we actually say is, what is skillful in these circumstances? By skillful, I mean, is it going to be conducive to the goal we're searching for? Is it really going to help? Is it going to be purposeful? What are the consequences going to be for ourselves and other people? That's what mindfulness has that behind it, just that you think, what's the consequences? Where's this going to lead? And so that if we say with sensuality, there always has to be some restraint. You know, whether a lay person or a monk, we have like restraint saying we're not going to have any partners or any sex. That's our restraint because we have a goal of developing very deep meditation. I'll maybe come up to that later on. But as a lay person in this world, you know, your restraint has to be, I would hope, just with your partner. Because, you know, you should know that, you know, if you're already having a relationship and you have sex outside of that relationship, now that's going to really hurt someone. And I don't think you, well, I may be wrong here, but I don't think you can actually say the other person will say, oh yeah, go ahead, go and do it, go and sleep with my best friend, I don't mind. I think that most people would mind. I could be wrong there, but please tell me. But most people would mind if you cheat in that relationship. So that's obviously an example of like harming someone else. So if our aim, you know, is not to harm another person, certainly if that was like an underage child, you know, we know that's going to harm that person. I mean, these sort of psychologists, sociologists know that sort of paedophilia, which is like, you know, having sex with someone underage, you know, is going to be harmful. In the same way that misusing your position of authority as a teacher, as a counselor, you know, with your students, there's just too much transference going on there. It's not a very clear relationship to complicate with any sexual or emotional or other entanglements. So that's usually a no-no as well. Why is it a no-no? Not because it's evil or because it says in some sort of book it's an abomination. Simply because it's going to be harmful. And against that, on the opposite side, when Buddhism talks about like homosexual relationships and sex, we ask, what's the harm in that? And of course, there is no harm in it, or at least no harm which I can see. And therefore, okay, off you go, enjoy your relationship together. So when we actually see that, you know, there's no evil, no bad, but it's not that we can do anything you like, we are wise about this. Is it going to harm another person? Is it going to harm ourselves? What's going to be the result of this? It's the same if it's like unprotected sex. You know, if you're obviously wanting to have a baby, fine. But if you don't want to have a baby, you know, have protection. So, you know, the idea of like, you know, in some religions that condoms being bad or sort of any type of contraception being evil, that certainly is not around in Buddhism because it's not what you're doing so much, but why you're doing it and what the effect is. You're not harming anybody, you're not harming yourself, it's for the greater good. Fine, that is called skillful. Just like a carpenter is skillful because they're making a piece of wood and they make it well. With little effort and they make a beautiful piece of furniture afterwards. That's skillful. Unskillful is if they don't know what they're doing, they'll take a piece of wood and make a big mess of it. So not good, not bad, but skillful and unskillful. So with a way of sensuality, we always have to have some restraint because we know it's going to be harmful. So first of all, we should be wise to know what's harmful, what isn't harmful to us. And obviously, just, you know, underage sex or sex outside of your relationship, you know, that probably would be harmful. So what happens? How can we have some strategies, you know, to actually to stop that harm or limit that harm? And this is where the Buddhist idea of mindfulness comes in, because with mindfulness, when you're aware of what's going on, you find you do have much more control in your life. And it's just like the carpenter learns more about their tools, so that when they're sawing, when they're playing, they're much more sensitive, so they don't make so many mistakes. And that sensitivity, you know, to your inner world, to your mind, to your lust, to your anger, to your desires, to what you want, is an important part of Buddhist practice. So we don't just say, no, don't do it. We don't say that's bad or that's unskillful. One of the nicest things about Buddhist practice is we help you actually find out what you're doing, why you're doing, and how to lessen the problems. Which is why that when we have these trainings of the mind in meditation to increase your mindfulness awareness, you start to see your whole mental processes and what happens. You know, where does lust come from anyway? And what actually is happening there? One of the problems is that when a person does, you know, you might be in a nice relationship, when you do see some other person, always be people who are attractive. Wow, she's nice, he's hot. Whatever it is, you know, there will be an attraction. Of course, that's natural. You can't stop that. And just to think that I'm not going to look at another girl now I'm married. Only you, dear. I'm not going to look at anyone else for the rest of my life. You know, that's a lie, isn't it? You can't do that. Or I'm not going to like anyone else. Again, that's a lie, because you'll have lust for other men and other women once you get married, once you have that relationship. So, you know, be realistic, and then say, what are we going to do about this? And obviously, that mindfulness is very important, because the mindfulness sees that whether it's lust, or whether it's anger, whether it's any other addiction, there is a whole train of mental activity, a process. And it's the mindfulness which can interrupt that process at any time and stop it before it gets too bad. What mindfulness does is like trying to stop a train. When if your train has left the station, it's going 110 kilometers an hour down the track with so much weight behind it. If the train driver tries to stop and put on the brakes because there's an obstruction on the road or on the rails in front of it, sometimes you just can't do that. It's going too fast. The momentum is too strong. A train going that fast takes maybe half a kilometer to come to a halt. Which is why that, you know, sometimes there's these terrible crashes when a car, you know, crosses the railway line. The driver sees it, but it's going too fast to stop. This is what happens when we try and catch our lust. Or whatever, you know, our anger, when it's a bit too late, it's gone too fast, the momentum's too strong, we can't stop it straight away. And many of you know that, you know, when you're in the power of lust, you can't stop just straight away, you can't just say, no, I'm going to stop now. You know, it's like a train just trying to put on the brakes and stop immediately, it just cannot be done. But the best time to stop a train is just when it's first moving out of the station. It's only going at maybe 1 kilometer an hour. And then if you put on the brake, it's easy to stop it. So one of the great things about mindfulness is actually you can see the whole process happening. You can stop it earlier if you think it's going to be unskillful, it's not going to help you. So a man who's got a nice wife, instead of just allowing the whole process to get so inflamed that you're just under the power of lust and you can't stop it anymore, you try and stop it earlier. And that way, if you see this really, really nice girl, and she's really amazing, you see that whole process happen, stop it now before it gets too late. It's called just a simple restraint. To be able to stop that thing, obviously, you have to want to stop it. And that's where the wisdom comes up. I mean, just don't be stupid and think you're in control of these things. Once you get too far, you are out of control, which is why I've told many women, who have problems with their husbands, that when a man gets lust, they literally are crazy. It's not a joke, but you are mad. One thing, you think you'll never get caught. You do get caught. You know, your wife is no idiot. She knows what's going on. She knows the signs. It's amazing just how many men have an affair and they think, you know, I'm in complete control. It's only a bit of fun. My wife won't ever even find out. And then when she does find out, then they come to me and have to sort out all this, you know, problems and try and give them another chance, or maybe no other chance, and divorce and all the problems that comes from that, and custody battles. There is a danger there. So don't let it go so far, you go crazy and you lose your common sense. You know, you will get caught. So, you know, are you willing to have that problem in your relationship and do that to this other person you live with and your kids? So this is actually our mindfulness and our wisdom don't allow us to go to such a point that we get crazy and we lose the sense of, you know, of reality. You don't always think that you're in control of this stuff, because you know that sexuality is such a strong force. Most of you can't control it. When you get so far, that's it. And relationships just keep going on, and sometimes you know it's going to hurt. You should have known earlier, so please learn. It's not a guilt trip. We're not saying, oh, you bad boy and you terrible girl, you shouldn't have done that, and you're excommunicated from the Buddhist society for life. Guilt, again, has no part of this, because if we have guilt, then we're running through fear. We should never work through fear. We should always work through just the wisdom, understanding the consequences, and being wise and being sharp. So, in sensuality, everybody has to have some sort of restraint. In other words, it's not just some free lunch. We can just eat at the table of sensuality as much as we want, and thinking nothing's going to go wrong. We have to balance our diet of sensuality. Not too much, not too little. According to our means and how we make that decision of how much. And also, you know, the best way is restraint for your partner. You know, just for her or for him. And keep it that way. And also understand the dangers there. And again, I'm a monk, because, you know, we draw the line as monks, having actually very little sensuality, especially sexuality with the opposite sex. Because again, that was going to really help our deep meditation even much more. It's one of the great teachings of the Buddha. He said that when you lessen the sensuality, your concern for the outer world, especially even sexuality, food and entertainment, literally your mind goes more inside. It doesn't get drawn outside so much. And so it makes it much easier to get into the deep meditations. And that might interest some of you, or might sort of confuse some of you. But it's one of the reasons why when you go on these 9-day meditation retreats, we always ask people to keep 8 precepts, which means no sexuality for those 9 days. In order that you can actually focus more on the inner world rather than the outer world, because the sensuality we're talking about there draws you out. And for the time you're meditating, you want to go in. And actually, you do get another type of happiness when you withdraw from that sensuality. So monks and nuns sort of usually are non-sensual. And because we're non-sensual, that sometimes people think that all Buddhists should be like that. And they start complaining, well, if everybody became a Buddhist, then we will not have any more people in the world. And that's a stupid comment, because only some people will go to be monks and nuns. Ordinary Buddhists, they have families, and they go to the casino. But if you go to the casino, be careful. You know, don't go too far. Know your limits, and if you get too far, like the train, stop before, you know, it's irreversible. And it's the same with sexuality, and as monks, this is where we draw the line, but we don't go too far. But as I said, the monks, even they get into food as well. One of the things I noticed when I was a young monk, as soon as I gave up sex, I really got into food. Food was incredibly delicious. It's almost, if you give up one thing, you get another thing, and I was very fascinated to see that actually when you go through puberty, that there comes a stage before that, actually, the sexuality, where you really get into food also, as if I was going backwards in my development. You know, as a young man, you get it really into food, and then you get into the girls, and I was going backwards, gave up the girls, and going into food again, before you actually go back again to sort of not being involved in that at all. But even actually with food, I mean, it's delicious, it's nice, but you obviously you can't eat too much, you get stomach aches, so you actually have to restrain yourself. So with all the sensuality we have, you know, it's almost like it has to be a voluntary restraint when we see the problems and difficulties, which it might give us. And the mindfulness actually gives us a sense of more control. So those people who have addiction problems in this world, whether addicted to sex, addicted to pornography, or addicted to gambling, or addicted to having one partner after the other, sort of, if they realize it's a problem, and they want sort of to try and restrict it, then the mindfulness practices helps them enormously. Of course, once they have to realize that it is a problem, and then how do we solve it, the mindfulness awareness of what's happening in your mind, and get different responses so that we don't go through the same old habitual reactions. What mindfulness is just like you see there's three exit doors at the front of this hall and two at the side. What mindfulness is you see just more than one doorway, so you can go through other doorways. Because in life we're creatures of habit. We think we always have to do things exactly the same way. We literally go through the same doorway every time. It's habit. We don't even look to see if there's any alternative. So it's the same reaction. You know, you see the beautiful girl, the same reaction over and over again. What mindfulness does, you actually see other ways you can deal with this problem. Or, you know, well, it's not maybe a problem, it may be something you want to do, but you've got more alternatives. An addict has got no alternatives at all. They're in a rut, a habit, which is so ingrained, they just go there and they cannot stop themselves. There are other alternatives all the time, but it's we need the mindfulness training actually to see that. So what mindfulness actually is actually when you come here on a Friday night, never sitting in the same place. I'm accepted here because I have to sit in this place. That's where the microphone is. But why is it that people always try and sit in the same place? So they park the car in the same way, always eat the same food. When they go to work in the morning, they always go the same way, or they go back the same way. Become creatures of habit. When you become creatures of habit, that's called no mindfulness. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to change. And I will challenge you tomorrow morning. One of my first examples of training in mindfulness is when you wake up tomorrow morning and you brush your teeth. Which side of the mouth do you start brushing your teeth? The left or the right? Or in the middle? Above or below? Tomorrow morning, I challenge you, start somewhere else. Start a different part of the mouth every morning. Come on, live on the wild side. That's a very simple example, but it makes a point that, you know, we're habitual, we always start at the same place. There's no reason to start at that place, but because we start at the same place, it's a creature of habit, we don't need to even think about or be aware of what we're doing, it just goes and does it without any mindfulness awareness at all. You literally are dulling your mind out and become a creature of habit. And it's the habits which cause the addictions, whether it's with gambling, with food, with sex, other sensuality, or say pornography. Why do people want to watch pornography on the internet so much? After a while, it does become an addiction. We get drawn in there, and after a while, we can't stop ourselves. Okay, you can stop yourself. There's other doorways you can go through. Or maybe other windows on the net. So first of all, you've got to know it's a problem, and then do something to stop it. Obviously, one of the reasons why people get addicted is there's a pleasure to it as well. And I was very fascinated to see the way the Buddha looked at sensuality by saying, yeah, there's a pleasure there, but there's also a payback afterwards. And the Buddha, this is 25 centuries ago, he compared such sensuality like to borrowing money, taking out a loan, which is actually very deep and profound, because when, say, you are, say, watching pornography or, you know, getting into some sort of sensuality, there's a lot of joy there at the beginning, but often we have to pay it back afterwards. And sometimes, like a loan, the only way you can pay it back is by taking out another loan to pay off the original debt, and the loan gets bigger and bigger and bigger until one gets into such a great financial mess, there's no way that you can actually pay back your loan. And that is actually just a beautiful description of addiction, and actually how it happens, because we get sort of some pleasure back in the first, and then to get some more pleasure, we have to do it again, but even more intense, and then more intense next time, until the pleasure, the only way we can get that pleasure is taking bigger and bigger doses of the drug, until we're really, really in a great debt. It's a very profound description of actually what addiction is and how it happens. And so the understanding that, please don't get that deep into any addiction that you get caught into such a debt trap. But it's also understanding that there are other pleasures in this world, not just the sensory pleasures. And it's true, the pleasures of just, you know, your family, friendship, you know, romantic love rather than sexual love. Those other pleasures should also be recognized and should be emphasized, because if the other pleasures can be used as a substitute for the instant gratification of some sensuality. So if you are addicted to some types of that sensuality, not just mindfulness, but give yourself another reward, another thing which is a bit more skillful than the one before. So that way that we can actually, we're not condemning sensuality, nor are we, you know, trying to prohibit sensuality by covering everybody up in a burqa or by saying it's evil. We're actually dealing with it in a wise way, so we can find our middle way. We don't go to extremes, so we have a means of stopping ourselves going to those extremes. We have gone to those extremes. We try and maybe learn a little bit of meditation so our mindfulness becomes more clear, so we can actually stop ourselves before we get to that point. So, for example, if someone is addicted to pornography on the web, the mindfulness actually tells you, look, as soon as you sort of press that button and enter that site, you're lost. You know, just like in AA or people addicted to smoking, it's once you've picked up that first cigarette and it's in your mouth, that's too late already. You can't put it down then. And you have to actually stop before you pick the cigarette up. And to be able to do that, we have these wonderful techniques which we call programming mindfulness. By programming mindfulness, what you do when that trigger is not in front of you, when you feel comfortable, when you think it's actually no problem, that's when you put the suggestions into your mind. You know, say it's cigarettes. I will not pick up that first cigarette. I will not pick up that first cigarette. I will not pick up that first cigarette. Because as a meditator, I know just how the mind works. It is conditioned. You know, you are susceptible to suggestion. And if you keep saying that to yourself again and again and again, in the quietness of, say, your bedroom, when you think it's not a problem, you say it then, when it's not a problem, it's not in front of you. When it's in front of you, it's too late. And after a while, what happens, say with a cigarette smoker, normally they would actually, you know, they're trying to give up, but they see a cigarette and it's in their mouth before they even know it. Because it's habit. It's just like brushing your teeth. You don't even need to think about it. You've done it so often. But what actually happens when they develop that degree of mindfulness and they condition themselves, I must not smoke that first cigarette. I must not pick it up. What happens just before they're about to pick it up, the mindfulness actually clicks in. It's like an antivirus, not a Norton antivirus, a Buddha antivirus, which actually stops the habitual process. And the thought comes up, no, I won't pick it up. There's a very, very effective way of actually stopping addictions. And because it actually, the mindfulness is actually pre-programmed in there to say, danger, you're going to pick up a cigarette. Or, you know, you're going to sort of start another affair when you're married. Or I'm going to bet too much at the casino. Or whatever else is you're doing. And that programming is very powerful because that picks up the signal. It's like a little red light starts the flashing in your mind, danger, 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 you're maybe going too far. And then you have the opportunity to stop yourself. A lot of times you can't stop yourself because you don't know what you're doing. The mindfulness isn't there, it's habits. And so that way we can actually stop ourselves. There's other ways of stopping yourself also. To remind yourself of the dangers, what happens when you've done that before. Because some of you, you know, you have had affairs outside of marriage. Sometimes you may have even sort of had sex unknowingly with a, say, a 15-year-old girl or whatever it is. You didn't know she was that young or whatever it is, or you've been attracted to somebody at work who's, you're their boss. All these sort of very, very dangerous areas of our life. Be careful. If you made a mistake once, be careful. Pre-program yourself. Don't go and create that pain and problems for yourself and others again. So you program yourself. Danger, danger, danger. And once you have the program danger, danger, you have all other ways of dealing with this. Obviously, that moving away from the stimulus, if at all possible, move away from the cigarettes, get out of the casino, just, you know, move out of that office or whatever else there is, if there's somebody there who's really sort of attracting you too strongly, you have the choice to do that. So you're actually taking control of your sensuality if it's going too far. And again, throughout this talk, you've seen that I'm not saying sensuality is bad, I'm just saying the extremes of sensuality. And you know, it's quite wonderful, fine, you're having a wonderful relationship, enjoying sex with your partner, homosexual, whatever. You know, that whatever is creating that bond between the two of you, that's wonderful, that's fine, but be careful not to take it to the point where it harms yourself and harms another person. And that sort of sensuality which you even see on the TV or you see on the movies, and that's not really the problem at all. Because, you know, it's a long time since I've seen the TV, to seen sort of people actually tell me what goes on those TVs. And but I remember, like, I went to visit my mother in London about 15 years ago. The first time I'd seen TV in about 7 years. And it was like a cop and movie show. I forget what it was called, not Defenders or something. Anyways, half an hour TV show, repeated every week. And as I was watching it with my mother, you know, for giving her company, I couldn't believe that how many people died in about half an hour. I was actually counting them. And I got to about a dozen or something, got shot and killed. And I couldn't believe this because before I became a monk, the TV was so tame. Because I had 7 years, I hadn't seen the actual progress, you know, of actually, you know, violence on TV. The contrast was so strong inside of me because the police show I remembered as a kid was a police show, anyone old enough might remember this, Dixon of Dock Green. And Dixon of Dock Green was this London bobby in the days when they didn't have guns, and if he caught a burglar, the burglar would say, "Ah, Sergeant Dixon, it's an honour to be caught by you, sir." And apparently they didn't do that anymore. Things have changed. And no one got shot. And if they did ever get hurt, if there was a bullet, they'd go, ooh, ooh, ooh. You wouldn't see any blood at all. And they'd just fall on the floor without any sort of gore or anything. But apparently things have changed enormously since then. But of course, you know, if you try and censor this, what happens? If you say, okay, so no sort of lewd speech on the TV, or no naked flesh, or no sex, what happens? It just goes underground. And of course, when it goes underground, that makes it even more interesting. You know, when it's sort of an illegal video, or when it's, you know, something that's not obviously the way to deal with sensuality, to prohibit it. You know, whether it's porn movies, on the internet or whatever, it always has to be some sort of restraint. And that restraint is done from understanding, is it going to harm me or harm another person? That makes it sensible. You can understand why. And that's the only real way of dealing with this. Whether it's oneself, one's kids, one's partner, whatever. You know, to appeal to their wisdom and encourage that wisdom. And actually to see the reason why these things are a problem. And actually give strategies to deal with addictions or with problems, but without the guilt trips, because Just that guilt makes things even worse. What happens with guilt, you're saying that you are worthless, you're a mistake. And people who are made to feel guilty or are punished, they have low self-esteem. Because of low self-esteem, they actually look for harming themselves. Now, obviously, that's a great generalization of a very complex process, but that explains it almost in a nutshell. You make a person feel guilty, they want to punish themselves, they don't want to be happy, so this idea of not harming themselves and not harming others, why? They deserve to be harmed, so that actually the addiction carries on. So that the guilt trips are actually counterproductive to actually having some sensible happiness and good health in a world of sensuality. But also that people ask, you know, why are monks celibate and why are nuns celibate anyway? Why do we actually reject sensuality? And are we somehow weird, depraved? I sometimes have good fun as a monk. It was over a year ago that I was invited to the Gay Pride Breakfast, which was at Curtin University, about a year and a half ago, I think. And when I asked to give a little talk, I just went up there and say, I am more deviant than all you gay, lesbians and transgenders, because I'm celibate. So I've got one, I'm the most deviant in the whole room. I'm just making a little joke about that. And obviously I respect people of all genders and all sexual preferences. But the point was that my preference, being celibate, was even more threatening to many people. Because what are monks and nuns doing? It's giving up? So are we afraid of sex? Is it the case we were hurt when we were young? Many people think that way. Actually, that I mentioned this story a few weeks ago, but this is actually, there was a monk, Ajahn Juwon. He was one of the old Thai monks who lived in this beautiful monastery, Putok. It's like a top hat mountain. And some of the Thai people know him. He was a very famous monk at the time. I went to visit him, and this lady came from Bangkok and asked this monk, oh, did you become a monk because you had a failed love affair? And he said, no, of course not. He said, ah, she said, that makes sense. You're ordained to forget, and you have forgotten by now. It's logically consistent what she said, but that's not why she ordained as a monk. And I never ordained as a monk because I got jilted in my love affairs. The reason I became a monk is because I know I had sex. I knew what sex was like. But you know, when I meditated once, I got this incredible experience which was better than sexual orgasm. And that was just really shocked me. What's going on there? And so I decided to become a monk just for a couple of years to find out, you know, what meditation was really like. And being a monk, you know, you have these rules of no sex. I didn't really understand what that was for at first. That's just what a monk does. But after a while, when you understand the nature of the mind, you understand that, you know, sensuality actually does draw you out into the world. And the meditation is actually going deeper inside. So actually, you know, the more you limit your sensuality, actually the easier it is to meditate. You know, you don't get drawn out so much. So that when I became a monk for a couple of years, sure, it was, you know, hard to restrain the mind looking out for the beautiful girls and the nice food and the TVs and the movies and all these other sensual things we were missing in the world. But I also had some interesting experiences. I mentioned actually going to visit my mother and seeing the TV after 7 years. But I also remember just the first time that after 7 years I flew on in an aircraft. Now, from Bangkok to London, I got a cheap fare on Philippine Airlines, on economy class. And this was, 25 years ago. You know, I couldn't believe just how sensuous and luxurious economy class on Philippine Airlines was. It was, my senses were amazed, because I'd been in a forest monastery, which was very, very austere. Well, I realized from that sensuality is also very relative. You know, to other people, cramped in the economy class of an aircraft 25 years ago, that was just so tough and just such an ordeal. But for me, who'd never sat on a chair for 7 years, being served like food which was hot and which was Western, which I could eat, I even got ice cream. I remember that ice cream. in a tub instead of on my bowl, you know, just melting into my rice and curry. And even the Muzak, you know, the Muzak on the plane, I never heard music for 7 years. That was amazing. That was just so sensual. I couldn't get that out of my head afterwards. So you see, that's obviously a joke for you, because you go on an aircraft and the Muzak on there it's yucky. And the food, aircraft food, people sort of just think is disgusting. And economy class, you're sort of so cramped up. But for me, because I've been living a far more austere existence in these forest monasteries. Now, I was amazed in the aircraft, there wasn't even any mosquitoes. The first time in 7 years I was free from mosquitoes for more than an hour or two. That was, to me, was luxurious and sensual. So you can see sensuality is also relative. And the sensuality which you're experiencing now, so 10 years ago, that would blow people's minds. The houses you live in, the cars you drive, what you see on the TV. This is nature. So the point is, the sensuality is going to get more intense in another 10 years' time. And we can't really stop it. We can't sort of have some great sense of someone saying, no, we're not going to have, we're going to go back to Dixon of Dock Green, we're not going to have any violence. We're going to have the presenter of the 6 o'clock news wearing a burqa. I don't know who that is anyway, some floozy on the Channel 9 or Channel 7, but you can't you can't do that. But the point is that, you know, we live in a sensory world. If you want to, you know, get out of the sensory world, you know, come to a retreat center or monastery for a few weeks to get some sort of idea of a perspective. And if you want to do meditation, sometimes you just have to leave that sensory world outside. Instead of being drawn outside, drawn inside. If you really want to get into deep meditation, it's an interesting thing to do, because you actually do get incredibly joy of actually not being caught up in that sensory world. What actually you do is you say, I can stop looking if I want to. And one of the great things of being a monk for so many years, you can actually look at a beautiful girl and an ugly girl and look at them exactly the same. Not many men can do that. Now, one story. I forget I should actually find out who this lady was, but she was some TV star. I think she was in Water Rats or something. And I don't know her name, but somebody told me she was really, really famous. If I told you her name now, I think you'd all know her. But I went to teach her, it was just an afternoon meditation session in Sydney. And this fellow had a little group in Darling Point, you know, like a really top affluent place of Sydney. And so he's in this little group, with about sort of 20, 30 people. I was talking about meditation, and this lady was kept on looking at me and smiling. And I didn't know, she was acting very strange, not like an ordinary girl. And, you know, in the end, and I just took it in my stride and taught the meditation, etc. And afterwards I mentioned to the person organizing, he said, that lady was acting really strange. And he told me that that was a famous TV actress. And I figured out she was looking at me strangely because I didn't recognize her. What she was actually saying, see, it's me, I'm the famous TV star. And I didn't know. It's quite obvious. That's a great experience when you're sort of a monkey, you don't know who's who. So because of that, you know, she's obviously must be some sort of very beautiful girl, and sort of an ugly girl. And what is beauty and ugly anyway? Why is that to attract us? When you're a monk and you meditate a lot, you don't see that anymore. And I love that, being a monk, having that opportunity to see a beautiful girl sits here, an ugly girl sits here. You spend the same amount of time as with both. You don't the ugly girl, go on, go, off. Because that sort of sensuality sort of starts to disappear. So it's great being able to, if you can, resist that sensuality, you can be more fair to other people. So this is why we do it as a monk, and we know we do lots of meditation. So it's great actually doing a little retreat, because you actually understand sensuality much more, and you can understand you can restrain it, so it's up to you, you can take it or leave it. Because sometimes people think they want to be free. In the free world, it's been able to enjoy our sensuality. We should have no limits, whatever we want to watch. The most violent movies or the most sexual movies, the most deviant sex or whatever. You know, let's have a free world. Let's allow people to do this. But the point is, people aren't free. Sometimes those sensory desires actually captivate us. We become a prisoner of our sensuality. Which is why that we have to have that sex. We have to have that drug. We have to gamble. And sometimes people get to the point they have to have those relationships outside of their marriage. And they hurt. And they realize they weren't in control after all. There wasn't freedom. So it's a great thing actually to investigate. You know, is it the freedom of sensuality, or has sensuality got its limits where you're in the prison of sensuality? You have to have it. So it's great finding a little bit of mindfulness and restraint, because you find you can almost like control your sensuality. You can go as far as you want. If you think it's going to harm another person, harm yourself, you can say no, you can stop it. And that's what we do with mindfulness, built of meditation, with wisdom, taking away the guilt, taking away the evil and the bad, and putting in the word skillful, and understand what that word skillful truly means. But it's really going to be serving our purpose, serving our interests, what we really want to get out of our life. When we understand that, we understand the Buddhist approach to sensuality. Not to deny it, not to cover it up, but to deal with it. And deal with it with wisdom, with mindfulness, in a way which can create the best happiness for ourselves and all other beings. So that's the talk on sensuality this evening. Thank you. No jokes this evening. I have to think of one pretty quickly. But last week I didn't have time for questions, so I tried to keep it a little bit shorter this time, just under the hour, for some questions. Has anyone got any questions on the talk about sensuality tonight? Yeah, okay, I can't see with the lights. Yes? Okay, you're asking, you say a level of violence, or we might even say pornography, or even gambling, or whatever else. Is there such a degree that it's good for the powers that be to ban it, because people can't handle it? I think the history has shown that banning things never works. When you try and ban something, you have to enforce that ban. That's where we get Taliban from, or Taliban. And not only that, but in banning things, you know, we get, where do we draw the line? And people are clever enough, you'll always get a way around the ban somewhere or whatever. And so instead of actually banning things, instead of saying that, you know, that people can't handle it, let's teach people to handle it. So I think the resources should be going in, instead of like banning things, teaching people how to handle these things better. Even actually to say no to them, to turn them off, rather than actually be, have sort of a blanket ban on things. It's a difficult one, because obviously that sometimes it's good to have some restraint, especially with kids who, again, haven't got the emotional maturity to exercise such self-restraint. But it's a difficult question there, because who has such emotional maturity to exercise self-restraint? Should we give everyone a restraint class and an exam and say, okay, now you are free to be mature and make your own decisions, but other people can't? Such a difficult decision with censorship, but what we have seen in history, people always find a way around it. Every ban, you know, when the American government tried to ban alcohol in the prohibition years, all it did was fed an underground criminal element, and people drank anyway. When people try and stop, you know, pornographic movies, there's always a way that people, if you really want it, you can get it. So isn't it much better actually to try and encourage people to be more self-reliant, self-responsible? Otherwise, I don't think it will work. So in Buddhism, it's very much the responsibility is on you. Karma, we're the owner of our deeds. So, you know, we take responsibility for it. So there you are, you have all those things in the world. How much you want to go, what you don't want to do, it's up to you. All the Buddhism could teach is to be wise, be discerning, understand what's going to be of help and what's not going to be of help, what's going to harm, what's not going to harm, and also teaching strategies so you can exercise a little bit more wise control over your decision making with a bit more mindfulness. So please, anyway, tomorrow morning, brush your teeth in a different part of your mouth. So beginning in training and restraint. Thank you for that question. It's a great question. I'm not sure if I could answer it adequately. I don't know if anyone can answer it adequately. You have to answer it yourself. Any other questions you have? Okay, I know that sort of, I'm just thinking of a joke to end up with. I know that the quote from Groucho Marx, who's one of my great heroes, when he asked, during the sexual revolution, when the radio reporter asked him what he thought about sex, he said, "I think it's here to stay." And there's a lot of wisdom. Humour is good because there's wisdom behind it. Now you can't stop it. Genie out the bottle. So how are we going to deal with it? Okay, that's Buddhism and sensuality.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho sanghaṃ namāmi.